Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to Idle Chatter. I'm Ray Bohax, your humble host, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Warren County, New Jersey. And it is a beautiful day today, thank God. And it is 42 degrees. Just looked at the thermometer, and sunny. And the snow is about 99% melted. In the shady areas, there's still snow, but it's really getting there. And I believe that tomorrow is officially the first day of spring. And I think many people throughout the country will be very, very happy to receive that change of season. And I also just want to, I think I would be remiss if I did not mention the terrible suffering that is happening out in Nebraska, Iowa, and the Dakotas, but I think predominantly in Nebraska, but it makes no difference. And the terrible flooding that's there, and the hardship, and the loss of life, and the loss of animals and livestock, and my prayers just go out to everyone there. And even though I personally cannot get there to help anyone, just like a lot of you can't, but, you know, prayer is a powerful thing, and the Lord will use His people in the best way that they can be effective, and what we need to do if we cannot physically be there, but to lift those people and those animals up in prayer, and just to see those poor cows in that water, and it must be so cold. It's just, and in other parts of the country, I've seen videos and pictures of farmers going out into the field with a shovel, just having a small hole in the snow where the cow's breathing melted it, and seeing that and digging a poor cow out of that. So it's just horrific. It is just horrific. But the Lord is good, and we will survive. They will survive, thank God, and they will be made stronger from it. So please do not forget to keep them in your prayers, which I know that you have not. But listen, I'm going to have a little bit of a different show today. And I just want to, I say that often, that I'm having a little bit of a different show, because I'm trying to really, really educate my audience. And I'm so thankful for those that do listen. And we have listeners from around the world, actually, but predominantly in the United States and Canada, from about 15 different countries that I am aware of, not counting the United States and Canada. But I feel that it is my duty to educate you, and to hopefully you apply that education to make your operation in agriculture, no matter what it is, more profitable. But today I'm going to touch on a hot topic, and what I mean by a hot topic, there's a lot of chatter about it that comes up every once in a while. And the impetus, actually, for today's show was a tweet that I sent out. And as if you know before, that I'm not really a big tweeter, and I still get it, like, wrong half, probably 60 or 70% of the time. I'm supposed to put, like, that hashtag or something in there, but I don't know. Well, whatever. Thank God I'm a better engine guy than I am a tweeter. But anyway, I had tweeted out something about autonomous tractors, and it got a lot of feedback instantly, and I guess they call it a thread, and it went on for quite a bit about autonomy. And I kind of offered a different opinion on autonomy than most people that responded to my tweet. And that really was the catalyst, the impetus for this show today. So it's not going to be about anything mechanical. It's not going to be about any procedure. It's not going to be any theory. But it's going to be my, and I'm saying this right up front, so for full disclosure, is that this is my opinion on autonomy. And it is, but it will be rooted in facts, and it will be rooted in experience. Not experience with autonomous vehicles, but experience in the industry and within the engineering community and the automotive world. So I ask you to please bear me out through this talk, regardless of what your opinion is of autonomous tractors, and listen to me, and I will try to, I will bring facts with every one of my statements, and then you could decide what you feel about it, and we can, and that's it. That's what America's about, right? That you could decide your feelings, and I could have mine. But as an engineer, I like to remove feelings. As an engineer, you have to remove feelings and emotion from things. A designer that designs the body of a vehicle or a tractor or an interior, that's a place for emotion. But with engineering, you have to remove emotion, and it has to be just hardcore facts. When it comes to autonomy, this discussion today is going to be strictly on autonomous tractors / autonomous farm machinery. I'm not going to get into anything about autonomous cars because that is extremely difficult and complex, much more complex than autonomous farm equipment. And the first thing we would need to do is to have proper autonomy on the farm before we could actually have any vehicles, cars, or trucks on the road. So in so many ways, the autonomous movement that is being represented in agriculture is actually the proving ground to autonomous vehicles. And if we can't get it to work on a farm, you're certainly not going to get it to work on I-80 going through Nebraska, or I-95 going up the Florida coast, or County Two-Lane Road. So let me put the, let me establish that. And the second thing that I want to establish in the beginning of the show today is that oftentimes the discussions from autonomy become muddied. They become mixed together. They become brackish, like salt water and fresh water together. And I really think that there are two distinct discussions when it comes to autonomous farm equipment, and they need to be the engineering aspect of it and the practical aspect of it. Now, if you were to talk to an engineer, and rightfully so, because that's his mindset and that's what drives technology, is that he will tell you that autonomous tractors are not possible, do exist. And obviously they do exist. Case IH has one, that Canadian company, I think they call it DOT, D-O-T, I forgot what it stands for. They have an autonomous piece of equipment going out in the field. And those are the things that come to mind, but I know there's many, many more. There's actually a couple of farmers playing with autonomy that I heard of. But we could use those two, and we'll probably use the Case tractor. I'll call it R2D2, all right? And this is, you know, because they've come so far with that and have the engineering prowess of the whole Case IH group to put into that. So there's two discussions, as I said. As far as the engineering of an autonomous tractor, is that possible? Yes. So this show today is not going to go back and say that it's not possible, because that would not be truthful. It is possible, they do exist. Now, do I feel that it's practical and a practical application for agriculture? And I'll tell you right now that I say no. So the thing is that do not confuse those two discussions, because if you speak to someone about autonomy, they're going to say, well, we could do this and we could do this. We could put a servo here. We could put a, we have GPS. We have all these other things. They go through this whole laundry list of things. And yes, that is real. But is it a practical application for agriculture? And I'm not saying, as far as I'm removing from that practicality equation, removing from that practicality equation, that it, it for that you would need to have a quite large farm with pretty straight fields and rectangular or square fields and what have you, and I'm removing the cost factor from it, and I'm removing all of that. All right, so when I say it's practical, and I'm saying that it's not practical, my whole basis is going to be rooted in the extreme complication that you would need for an autonomous tractor. All right, so that's where we're going to go, and then I'm going to branch off as the show continues on into some different areas. Now, keep in mind that autonomy has been used in many large factories for years, and the first auto plant I ever went to, I was a young boy, was in 1978 in Belvedere, Illinois, where they made the Chrysler, the Dodge Omni, and the Plymouth Horizon, and they had a self-guided vehicle that looked almost like an airport little tractor that moves the luggage and everything around, pulls the trailer. I think they call it a tractor tug. I think they call it a tractor tug. And they had those in the plants, and the way they worked, there was a magnetic strip on the concrete, and this tractor tug followed this magnetic strip, and it was able to stop at every workstation, and then the people could unload whatever parts they needed, and this tractor tug would go around. So that was autonomous, and that was in 1978, but it was like a trolley. Instead of having a wire overhead, it was following this magnetic strip, and it would have a flashing light that would keep beeping a horn as it went by, so that if anybody stepped in its path, that it would that they would know that it's coming. All right, so that's autonomy in its simplest and most simplistic form, I should say. But what needs to be recognized is that for autonomy to work in a farm field, that the controller that controls this tractor, the ECU, the logic, whatever term you want to use it, the brain for this R2D2 tractor, I'll call it R2D2 as I said, needs to be able to blend, a blending of thought / logic, recognition, and applied mechanics. So let's stop and look at that for a second. The controller for this autonomous tractor needs to be able to have a thought process that is very near to being human. And it needs that thought process / some sort of logic within that computer, that management system, to be able to make decisions. And these decisions, so you could say, well, that's easy because we already have that. We have auto steer in a tractor, we have auto steer in a combine going off a satellite and GPS mapping. So forget about it, hot rod, we already got that. No, you don't. Because those are not autonomous. They have, just like when you go on an airliner, the pilot hits autopilot, but he is there watching everything. So auto steer and that whole self-driving is with human intervention as an overseer, as a guide to that, and as a sentry to watch what's happening. A true autonomous tractor has nobody in it, and that's why Case, even when they made their version, they displayed it without a cab, because they wanted to give the visual of a truly being autonomous, not having the public view it as confused with a higher end of auto steer. So what will have to happen is that this logic, this thought process, and then it needs a recognition. It needs to be to recognize what is happening around it, what's going on, all right? And then it needs to be able to control the mechanics to apply all of this, because regardless of the computer logic, there still needs to be a mechanical function for that tractor to be able to go through the field, to turn the wheels, to turn the PTO on and off, the sprayer on and off, what have you. So there needs to be a lot of, so the software needs to talk to some sort of controls, and the controls need to be able to work the machine. And without that, we basically have nothing, because if we think back to just a few seconds ago, when I said about the auto plant, that was like a trolley. It had a magnetic tape in the concrete. The self-guided vehicle would follow that tape, and that was basically the end of it. There was nothing more. It just needed to start and stop, and it didn't even have brakes, if I recall. It would just shut the power off to the electric motor, and then the thing would just stop immediately because there was no power to it. Right, so we need to blend that. We need to blend that logic, the thought process, that recognition. Now, as an example of, we'll say, autonomy or robotics, right? Now, robotics are very common today. You go look at any auto assembly plant, anything that's high volume manufactured, there's a great deal of robotics in it. But robotics cannot be confused with an autonomous tractor. So now, let's look at a simple task. My wife, Charlotte, is a kindergarten teacher. And as a kindergarten teacher, she hopes that the students start the first day of school knowing how to tie their shoes. Some of them do, and some of them do not. So one of her first tasks is to go over tying the children to learn how to tie their shoes. All right? So now you're an engineer. Right, you're a farmer engineer, and now what you want to do is you want to come up with a robot, a machine, a device, whatever you want to call it, that will do this simplistic task of a kindergartner, four or five, six-year-old kid, whatever they start kindergarten at, to be able to tie their shoes. So now what we're going to do is we're going to pit your engineering prowess, your computer programming skills, your mechanical skills to be able to execute this to emulate a task that a kindergartner could do of tying their shoelaces with a bow. Now, once you look at it that way, I want you to, I'm going to break away for a second, and I'm saying this with the utmost of respect. The thing is that until you've actually done calibrations and done this, and I'll get into my background in this in a minute or so, so you could feel that there's some value that I'm talking, not just talking to hear myself talk, all right, is that, you know, if you talk to a non-farmer, they think it's so simple. You have the winter off, right, you're a row crop guy, you got the winter off, you work for a couple of days out of the year, you throw some seed in the ground. Then you go back out, the seed comes, you have the next couple of months off, and then you come back in the fall, and then, you know, if you put 100,000 seeds in a plot of land, you have 100,000 ears of corn, and then you go through, you harvest the corn, and then you bring it to the grain elevator or whatever you do with it, and they give you a lot of money for it, and then you say, well, now it's Thanksgiving, and now it's Christmas, let's go away to the islands, and then we'll come back in the spring and do the same thing. All right, so they have this approach that they formulated in their mind that has nothing at all to do with reality. And sadly, and that's why I said I'm saying this respectfully, a lot of people that think about the autonomous tractor, and based upon what I've heard people say, what I've read in some publications, and also just recently, as I said, the feedback on Twitter, they could put a sensor, they could do this, they could do this, they could do that, and everything. Yeah, that's like the person in the city saying it's so easy to be a farmer, you throw seed in the ground, and you just got the bags of money afterwards when you're harvesting, all right? So let's get that thought process rearranged, because now your task is to basically make a robot, an autonomous machine, no human interaction, an autonomous machine that is going to tie a kindergartner's shoes. All right, now I'm not going to go on for an hour with this, but these are the few basic things that you have to think about. Well, where is the child putting their foot in relationship to the machine? So you could say, well, that's no big deal because we could have an area where we tell them to stand with the shoe. Okay, fine. You could do that, all right? But now we have to say, well, how much tolerance are we going to be able to accept if the person doesn't stand exactly in that spot? And what about a person that has one size shoe, one width, and a person that has a much larger foot and a much wider foot? So if we have this spot, we have to be able to encompass where they're going to stand, and now we're going to have to determine what range and determine engineering you call resolution to for them to stand. So if they have a smaller foot, do we make the pad larger? But then how does that determine? Well, okay, well, you could say, well, there's a sensor. And we'll discuss that in a few minutes. So the sensor is going to determine the size of where the foot is. Okay, fine. All right, so now we got that taken care of in theory, right? We put the seed in the ground. We'll just wait for the money to come. Now, the next step is where are the laces laying? I know when I put my work boots on every morning, I have to move the laces around because one lace is inside, one lace is underneath the sole, one lace is on top, the other lace is someplace else. So where are the laces laying for this shoe tying procedure? So then you could say to myself, all right, fine. Well, what we'll do is we'll just instruct the person that they have to put the laces in a certain area so that this R2-D2 robot could grab it. Alrighty, fine. But now, what is the diameter of the lace? I know some shoes have a thicker lace, some have a round lace, some have a more of a rectangular flat lace. So we now have to write a program and have some sort of ability for this robot to be able to identify not only the size of the foot, the shape of where the laces are laying on the shoe, because it's untied, so the laces are laying, and now we have to determine the shape of the lace. Next thing is we have to determine how many eyelets does the shoe have. And if the shoe, and not only how many eyelets, but how many eyelets do not have a lace in them. When I untie my boots, right, it has a hook on the top, and I only untie two eyelets down and open up the tongue so I can take my foot in and out. So now, does this shoe have six eyelets, and when the person takes it off and then puts it back on, four eyelets are empty? Does it have four eyelets and two hooks on the top? Alrighty, so now, and the next thing is, how tight does this person want those laces tied? So I'm using this as an example of how this is not so simple, and that's only tying a shoe. So a simple task that a child can do becomes an engineering nightmare. And the people who are computer-oriented and software-oriented and work in that industry, God bless them, they have knowledge that I would never have. But really, if you were to look in their subconscious, they think that they could replicate the human being. That the sensory, all of the senses that the person has, the thought process, and they think they could do with computer code. And it's called, to a certain extent, and somebody may be listening to this that writes code, but I'm going to call it artificial intelligence, because it's a level of artificial intelligence. And we have to really look at and say that there is not a computer that can encompass the thought process and the physical attributes of a human being. Yes, they do it in Hollywood with a robot with a man inside there, but in reality, and once you see how hard it is to make a machine, an autonomous machine, to tie a kindergartner's shoelaces, when my wife could teach a child to tie the shoelaces in a few minutes and with some repetition have that down pat. So now, what gives me the I'm not going to say the authority, because it's no authority, but what gives me the background or the credentials is probably a better word for me to talk to you about this. First of all, I have never done any programming or worked with any autonomous vehicles or equipment whatsoever. Alrighty, but I have a background as an engine calibration engineer, and I test drove for, I had a contract with BMW of North America, and I was an engine and driveline, which is transmission, torque converter, and engine calibration evaluator. So I would not write the code. What I would basically do is I would evaluate the calibrations on pre-production cars, and as far as everything is concerned, from idle quality, startability, idle stability, transmission shift points, the whole nine yards, because on a modern vehicle, what you're basically doing is that you're integrating the engine with the rest of the driveline, and that is what calibration is. So that is a very simple yet challenging task, because whenever you're going to calibrate something, it becomes a juggling act. Now, if you look at a juggler, or you're taking a ball and you're juggling it up there, you're throwing it and catching it, throwing it and catching it, all right? So you're juggling one ball. Now, I say to you, now come and juggle two balls. Well, if you're a good juggler and you have some experience, you'll probably be able to do that. And now I come, say, juggle three balls, juggle four, juggle five, juggle six balls. And then what happens is that maybe you get one or two rotations with them, and then everything goes crashing on the floor. Well, as a calibrator, as a calibration engineer, you are juggling probably 100 balls at one time, not just one or two. And you're juggling 100 balls at one time, and because those balls are not only the drivability of the vehicle, how the smoothness of the vehicle, engineering we call making it invisible to the consumer, to the driver, how the transmission shifts, how it goes into gear, all of these different things, idle stability, how the throttle input feels, and plus you need to meet fuel economy and emission standards. So now you're juggling arguably 100 balls at the same time. And that's a simple calibration for you to get in your pickup truck or your wife to get in her car, her minivan, her SUV, and start it on the farm and drive 3 miles, 5 miles, whatever, to town. Or drive across the barnyard. Or drive to go see you in the field a mile or two away. There's so many things that have to go on, and with this integration of these engines and these drive lines today, that it's a simple task. You could say, well, you know, I was able to do that years ago. Henry Ford was able to do it with a Model A and a Model T prior to that. Yes, but it was completely different, because it was a ball that was juggling that needed the engine to start to be able to put power into the transmission. There was no emissions, there was no fuel economy standards, there was no starter. You cranked it with a starter or with a hand crank or what have you. So once you get into that, you have to see that this juggling act, and as I said, the depth of the calibration to drive your pickup truck down to check your crops a mile away is nothing compared to trying to make an autonomous tractor, all right? And make an autonomous tractor that will function day in and day out. Now, when I was a test driver for BMW, they were coming out with something called an SMG transmission, which is sequential manual gear change. And it was a transmission that was going to come out in their performance car. It was called the M3 for somebody who's a car enthusiast. And I did a good portion, probably a third of the test driving on the pre-production. I probably was more prototype than pre-production SMG transmission, and we did that here in New Jersey, in New York State, and in Manhattan, in New York City. All right, and in essence, what was determined by the industry, not just BMW, by the industry, is that after many, many hours of work, and when we got the product here, it already went through its early development stages in Europe and Germany, and then when it came here, it was half-baked, for lack of better terms, but, you know, the dough was already mixed, and it was in the pan, and the cake dough was already in the pan in the oven, but it was half-baked. But what the industry has determined, and what an SMG transmission is, that was their trademark name, was that it's a manual transmission. It's not an automatic transmission. It's a manual transmission that you shift without a clutch. And it had paddle shifters on the steering wheel, and it had a look like a shifter, almost like a joystick. I don't think that version ever came into production, but I had like a joystick, and you would move it around to shift it. Now, the drive away was pretty good, wasn't great. It wasn't great because what happened was that it had no clutch pedal, but it had a clutch type of mechanism. It wasn't a true clutch like you would think, but anyway, we'll say a clutch type of mechanism to engage it, is that it was not able to feather the clutch out. So we had to write a calibration that would read the input from the throttle position sensor, because it was drive-by-wire, there was no throttle cable, throttle position sensor, to try to determine how much RPM we needed to have to engage the clutch. And what happened with this particular type of transmission, it was very jerky at low speeds because it did not have the ability to feather the clutch out. And also the algorithm, the mathematical calculation we needed to determine was based upon how much throttle angle versus how aggressive we're pressing the throttle. But at that particular point, the vehicle did not know what the road conditions were. It didn't know if I was trying to go up a hill when I stopped at this, or I was going down a hill or what have you. And then eventually they tried to put an inclinometer into it to try to calculate that. But that was a whole other nightmare, because it's a whole other ball of wax. So, but what was determined was that the best we could get it, the upshifts were pretty good. If the drive away from a stop was bucky, it was almost like a person, if you pulled alongside someone and you drove away, tried to drive away gently from a traffic light, from a stop, the person next to you would say, boy, that guy's got a $100,000 car, he doesn't know how to drive it, because that's how it looked. It looked like a person who doesn't know how to drive a stick shift that would buck a little bit and then go. If you went away aggressively, it was much smoother because it saw that throttle angle on the RPM. And then once it got rolling, the shifts were pretty good when you shifted it. Like I said, you had to move the shift lever to shift it, but there was no engagement of a clutch. But what was really a problem was the downshifts. The downshifts were a real issue. And the best we could get it when that project was over, as far as my end was concerned, is that approximately 60% of the downshifts were acceptable. They weren't great, they were acceptable, and 40% were very bad. So if you tried to go from 6th to 4th, or from 3rd to 2nd, or what have you, and you needed to match rev, there had to be an algorithm to match rev the RPMs, and then we actually had an algorithm there to blip the throttle on the downshift, which is actually kind of cool, but to blip the throttle to try to make the downshift gear engagement better, to put inertia in the crankshaft. But anyway, 40% of them were bad. And the 60%, probably out of the 60%, half of them were only okay. Now, what was the industry has determined was that a good driver would have 85% of their downshifts would be good, would be a proper downshift and would be smooth, and there would be a smooth drop down in engines and in the gear change and the engagement of the clutch when the clutch comes out with the RPM and match rev, and it would be a smooth downshift, close to akin to an automatic without all of that hydraulics. So a good driver, but it was also determined that an excellent driver would get 99% good downshifts, and the best we could make was 60%, and out of those 60%, probably, like I said, half of them, 30% were really quite poor. So that's only a gear change from going from fifth gear to third gear, or from sixth gear to fourth gear, or whatever. That was only a gear change, or rolling up to a stop sign or to a stoplight and coming down in the gears. Whereas in a normal application, an experienced driver would push the clutch in, kick it into neutral, and roll the last couple of feet. But to try to accomplish that, akin to like tying the kindergartner's shoes, it's almost impossible to replicate the intelligence, thought process, and the synergistic effect that a human being has when they're operating a piece of machinery. So the other thing is that it could not anticipate gear changes in traffic, whereas you driving a manual transmission would be able to anticipate, say, man, that car up there is stopping, I see the brake lights go on, so I'm going to leave it in first gear. All right, so it had a lot of issues, and I don't want to belabor it. But then we found also that the software was not able to act properly with the mechanical functions, and then we also saw that some of the mechanical aspect, be it a servo or be it something else, was too slow to respond to the commands. Right? Now you could say, well, what about an automatic transmission? Fully automatic transmission is a little bit different because it has the torque converter, all right, and it's using hydraulic fluid, and it has what we would call 2 or 3 degrees of freedom, throttle angle input, and mechanically, it's much more forgiving because the torque converter will absorb a lot of that inefficiency or that bad gear change. So it makes it a lot easier to calibrate than a manual transmission. But the SMG transmission, we were trying to have a drive like an automatic with the shift, with the logic of a person who knows how to drive a manual transmission. So now, a lay person says, well, let's just put sensors all over the place. And they think that sensors are the cat's meow, the godsend to everything. A sensor is the answer. And to a certain extent, they are correct. I'm not going to say that, all right? But a sensor is only going to be, a sensor does nothing more than, and I don't care whether it's on your planter, whether it's on your combine, whether it's on your pickup truck, whether it's on your seed meter, or on your sprayer. I'm trying to think of things and not repeat myself, but all a sensor does, it converts a physical condition to an electrical signal. That is it. So you have to be able to, so if you're trying to determine, let's say, a coolant temperature sensor on an engine, there's a certain resistance that sensor is made to identify the coolant temperature. So let's say, and I'm making up arbitrary numbers here, let's say at 200 degrees coolant temperature, the sensor is made to have 100 ohms of resistance. At 190 degrees, it may have 205 ohms of resistance. And that is what is called the resolution or the range of a sensor. Now, when you look at like a gauge, a mechanical analog gauge on your sprayer or a tire pressure gauge, the resolution is the range, same thing, it's the range that it could measure. So if you're looking at your sprayer and you have a gauge that goes from 0 to 60 pounds, then half point in its resolution, the midpoint is 30 pounds. All right. Now, if you had a gauge that went from 0 to 1,000 pounds, you would not be able to read accurately 30 pounds because there's not enough resolution. And that's why we all have different tire pressure gauges, because we'll have a tire pressure gauge that reads from 0 to 20 pounds or 0 to 15 pounds, and then we'll have one that reads from 0 to 120 pounds. And what you want to do is have the most resolution. So the sensor only converts a something, whether it's a temperature, a mechanical state, engine RPM, hydraulic pressure, into an electrical signal, because the control unit, the microprocessor, doesn't understand 500 psi of hydraulic pressure, but it understands a certain output on the sensor. So, but once again, the sensor has to be designed to be able to have the proper range that we need to identify with, and it also needs to have enough resolution. But the other thing is that once you send that data from that sensor, that output voltage or that resistance, or it could be a sine wave or a square wave, what have you, it goes into that ECU, it has to do something with it. So there has to be a control logic, and lots of times it's mathematic based and called an algorithm, and has to be a control logic that is going to be able to take that data from that sensor, from that autonomous tractor, and say, okay, fine, right, we have 72 ohms coming in, and that's our pressure on the sprayer. Right, 72 ohms is the pressure on the sprayer from this autonomous tractor. And then, but what does that mean to it? There has to be a language written inside the processor for it to be able to identify, to be able to see what that is. And then that data goes into a decision-making process, which is basically going to say, okay, based upon 72 ohms on the pressure sensor on the boom of this sprayer that we're pulling with this autonomous tractor, and that we want 30 gallons per acre, all right, with this nozzle, with this tip on it, we need to go this fast. So the thing basically is that there's a lot of plotting. I mean, it looks like to try to get this to happen, and then you have to put in set points, or you have to put in points where it's like, what is if we're going 5.2 miles per hour? Do we extrapolate that out to 6, or do we keep it at 5? So it's very, very complicated. So a sensor is only going to give you a convert the mechanical condition to electrical signal. And for instance, let's say the autonomous tractor is going down the field, and there's a pothole, there's a hole in the field, a big groundhog hole, all right? You would see that in the tractor, and they say, yes, this could happen with auto steer, but if you're not playing with your phone and you're paying attention, you would see that. And well, there's some sort of obstacle in the field, so there's this big, huge groundhog hole, right? This big. What you would do is that you could basically kick the auto steer off, or you could guide it around it, because you'd be able to say, I'm going to just skim it, I'll move over 6 inches, and I'll come back onto my path, and I'm not going to put my row unit and have that drop down into that groundhog hole, or my wheel from my sprayer drop down there, and have that boom drop and hit the ground and bend, which happened to me last year. But anyway, so it needs to be able to see that hole, make a decision what to do with that hole, and be able to determine that, should I move over 6 inches, should I not move over, should I go straight, should I hit it, what have you. So you're getting the idea with this, is that anything that you take for granted, akin to the kindergarten of tying the shoes, has to be put into some sort of software to try to anticipate every condition that could possibly come up, or if not every condition, the lion's share of those conditions, for this to be a viable technology. And the software to do this is because, remember, in most softwares, there could be a level of artificial intelligence where it makes a higher level of decision, but the software, the computer, the control unit, is nothing more than a comparator. It's an information gatherer. It says, based upon this, based upon this, based upon this, I'm going to make this decision, all right? And that is what needs to happen. But you make those decisions continuously as you're operating the tractor in the field. You're making those conditions, and let's say if you have an auto steer, and all of a sudden you say, geez, you know, the sound of the engine, the pitch changed, right? The pitch changed, or I felt a little buck there. What's going on, all right? So to say, well, we're going to have a sensor that reads RPM and reads load and reads this. Yes, you could do it. Back to my original thing. Engineering-wise, can you do it? Yes, but is it practical, and how complex is it to try to put these scenarios, which you could never emulate all of them, into this computer code to try to, and then have a sensor that has enough resolution, that has enough range, and the ECU software that's able to understand that. So that is, keep in mind that is just a comparator. It takes data in, and it's going to make a decision based upon it. Now, getting back to BMW, to the M3, using that as an example, I'm only using this because it's very simplistic compared to all we're trying to do is get the engine to run right. We're not trying to drive it, okay? The engine to run right, the transmission to shift right. It's not self-driving. So now, with the M3, what I noticed, because I'm a stickler for idle stability, is that when you got into traffic and it started to, the idle started to roll, and it was very particular because you had to reach a certain temperature in the plenum. It was an individual runner intake manifold with 6 throttle bodies, but they tied it together with a plenum. So that meant we had resonant pulses from the cam overlap coming back into the plenum, all right? And then at idle in traffic, but the plenum temperature had to be elevated to a certain point. I don't remember what it was. At a certain amount of humidity in the air, that it would start to roll. And the idle would start to roll. It would start like a diesel with air in the line, or when the fuel is gelled. And then what you do is you would blip the throttle, and then it would stabilize, and then about 30 seconds later, it would start to roll. If it was 10 degrees cooler under the hood or had less humidity, it was fairly stable. But you had to get into a certain condition, and you had an idle instability. And then what would happen is that they used what's called degrees of freedom. I did a show on this a while back, which is adjustability. We were changing cam timing, idle air control position, RPM, fueling, what have you, all of this, and the original math that we had in there was not right. So the algorithm was not correct, and at that particular point, she would start to roll. We were able to correct that by changing by changing what they called the idle spark, which was the amount of timing and used duty cycling the timing in and out. But what had happened is that once we changed the idle spark, it started to fail the emissions test. So actually, it was cleaner when it was rolling, but you're not going to buy a $100,000 car and have your wife sit in traffic with it and it's surging 300 RPM. That's unacceptable. But contrary to what you would think, is that the emissions were actually cleaner when it was rolling than what we had to do to make it not roll, and they actually had to play with the camshaft design to get this to not roll, right? So it's very, 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 very complicated. Now, with this basic understanding of what it's like to get your engine to run, to drive to town with your pickup truck, all right, and all of the obstacles in the calibration that there is. Now, let's apply all of the things and changes that happen on the farm, in the field, that this tractor, this autonomous tractor, or this autonomous sprayer will encounter without any human intervention, all by itself. And as I said in the beginning, I'm going to repeat it again because I don't want you to lose sight of it. Can autonomous vehicle, do autonomous tractors exist? Most certainly. Can they do most things? Yes. All right. Is it 50%, 60%, or 70%? I don't know the number. I'm not in an industry. But the fact of the matter is they cannot emulate 100% of what a driver would have in that tractor, even with the auto steer evoked. Now, that's like basically saying, well, the airliner, you know, 70% of the time, you know, it lands fine, and the other 30% of the time, the wheels fall off and it crashes. That's the aspect of autonomy that I feel is almost, that I'll say it, is insurmountable, because there's so many elements that need to come together, and we cannot replace the human brain, the experience, and also the thought process and the sensors. Now, you may think that I'm knocking computers and knocking computer controls. I'm not. Computers are wonderful. They're great for doing high-level math very quickly. They're great for repetitious tasks in a controlled environment. For instance, like a robot painting a vehicle in a car assembly plant or assembling some parts in a controlled environment. But it is impossible for an engineer, and no matter how wonderful an engineer is, and if you have a calibration guy and he's calibrating this or trying to interface the electronic controls, the math inside the ECU, the calibration software, the thought process, the artificial intelligence, with the mechanical, with the basic mechanics that need to happen inside that tractor to make it do everything properly, then he will admit to you that there's a long way to go and a lot of stumbling blocks, and they would say to you, if they're honest, as good of an engineer I have, it would be so complicated and expensive and so many things to go wrong for me to make a robot that could tie a kindergartner's shoes, let alone a autonomous tractor that can be put out into the field while you're sleeping and have nothing go wrong. Ready? So, now, let's say, even though that I feel that it is impossible, will they get closer to it? Yes, just like we got closer to the shift, the downshifts on the SMG transmission. We never got it to 100%, and I don't think they even offer that transmission anymore, because like I said, my contract, I worked with BMW for 2 years and they as a subcontract engineer, and then they moved all of the... with 99% of the test driving to California from New Jersey, and that contract was up. But anyway, so the thing is that, let's say that I am wrong, and they could anticipate all of these things like the human mind, which, trust me, they will not be able to, all right? So, and they get it all right. So now let's consider the following simplistic things as we start to talk, go into this. So now we have this autonomous tractor, you bought into it on your farm. You think it's I'm not saying you think it's great. It's great, right? You could be out in the field. You could be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You could get your crops in when you want. You could spray when you want. You could do all of that. There's no issues whatsoever. In engineering, we call it a great technology, right? It's a great technology, but, you know, I'm saying that the execution is poor, meaning that that you really can't accomplish what you want. So let's say they get this all nailed in, right? They get this all nailed in. So now this is the real life aspect of it. The real life aspect that, so they get it right, now consider this. This autonomous tractor is going through the field. It's got a diesel engine because it needs the torque. It's lighter than a tractor with a cab and with air conditioning, what have you. But it still needs the torque to do the farm work. So it's got a diesel engine. And albeit a smaller one than you would need in a row crop tractor, but it has this diesel engine, and you're going down the field, and everything is wonderful. You're putting your crop in. All right? Now, a diode, which is a one-way electrical check valve, because an alternator on an engine actually creates alternating current AC, and a diode chops it to DC. So the alternator is making AC, and a diode starts to go bad inside it, and it feeds into the control system non-rectified, or unrectified is probably the better word, unrectified AC. Well, let me tell you something. You could take a modern computer-controlled gasoline engine or a modern Tier 4 diesel, and you start to feed it unrectified AC into that control logic from an alternator with a bad diode, and all bets are off how that thing is going to run, if it's even going to run at all. It could buck, it could stall, it could put a check engine light on, it could go into default, it could have no power, all right? It could start to surge, it could overfuel, it could underfuel, because that would be akin to try to determine every lightning strike in the country, where it's going to go, where it's going to land. And electricity, as we all know, is very funny. It has no rhyme or reason to it. To itself, it has a rhyme or reason, but it doesn't divulge that to you. And you could have two diodes, you could have two alternators, one with this one diode bad to a certain level, another diode in that whole circuit fail to the same extent, and the engine controller will respond two different ways. All right? So now, let's talk about this scenario. R2-D2, my autonomous tractor is going down the road. It's 5,000 acres away. Everything is great. You look on your cell phone. Oh, man, this is beautiful. Look at this. Everything is planting the seeds and blah, 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 whatever it's doing, right? It starts to get, a diode goes bad while it's running, which could happen. Diode goes bad, unrectified AC. What happens to it now? So now the engineer says, we could put fail-safes in, all right? But those fail-safes get to be so complex. Think about how we couldn't get the transmission to downshift, right, at BMW, all right? Those fail-safes get to be so complex to try to identify an unrectified AC signal in that part of the sine wave and how it's going to interpret this, that's almost impossible. Like you standing there and saying, man, I think that lightning is going to strike there. Yeah, well, if you're in the middle of Oklahoma in a 1,000-acre wheat field and you have a metal pole up there, there's a good chance that the lightning is going to strike there. But if you're in the forest in Pennsylvania, you can't tell where the lightning is going to strike. All right, if you're out in your cornfield, you can't tell where the lightning is going to strike, but it's going to strike someplace. So all of the people that are so pro-autonomy, which I am not against, pro-autonomy, I'm going to ask you that question. How is your system going to respond? And if you're honest, you could say, I don't know how it's going to truly respond with a bad diode. And I could simulate a bad diode in the laboratory, but I can't simulate how it's going to respond in the field. And that is why they do field testing on cars. That's why we were driving the cars on the road, because on the test track is a different story. Okay, next thing, all right, you put your autonomous tractor away for the winter, the spring comes, you come out, you get it running, whatever you have to do, you get into the field, however you get it there, I have no idea, all right, and now it starts to go. Well, during the course of the winter, a mouse made a big, nice nest where you couldn't see, right where there's wiring, there's a ground wire there. Okay, a very important ground wire. And the mice made this nice nest. They were very happy, and they had their babies, and they were all using that as a bathroom, and they were taking a tinkle on it. Well, that is very corrosive. So now we have a high impedance ground. So you start it, the autonomous tractor goes out into the field. At that particular point, the ground is high impedance, but it was still within the threshold of it accepting it. And it's running and everything is fine. Now it heats up. All right, it heats up under there from working. It's now whatever chisel, not, well, we don't chisel plow anymore, right? We're cultivating the field, and now it's getting hotter underneath the hood, wherever the ground may be, and now that ground gets to a point where it's a threshold where it will no longer accept it. How are you going to engineer, how are you going to anticipate how that autonomous vehicle, that autonomous tractor, is going to respond with a high impedance ground on a circuit? You cannot. You could simulate it. You could simulate it in the laboratory, but it is not going to be the same because the conditions are not going to be the same in the field as into the laboratory. And now we have this whole tractor that's driving itself, all right, driving itself. So now you can say, well, I'm going to put a software of something in it that it's going to acknowledge it. Well, then again, it comes back to writing a code. At what level does it acknowledge it? What default strategy does it take? Does it go into like a limp home mode and pick up the planter and try to chug its way home? Or does it screw up, pardon my language, the whole autonomy thing and the thing takes off at 15 miles an hour and the dirt is flying all over the place, all right? You cannot anticipate how that's going to happen, all right? And if you did anticipate everything, this tractor would cost about $20 million, like an airliner, all right? Because you have to take the human element out of it, all right? Next thing, all right? Autonomous tractors going across the field. It starts to spring a leak in the radiator. All right, spring a leak in there. A human operator would say, your temperature didn't go up, but it goes, I smell antifreeze. I smell coolant, right? And let me stop and get off and see what happens. Oh, man, I kicked up that deer antler and punched a hole in the one tube of the radiator, right? It's leaking a little bit. So what you would do with your planting, you would pick up the planter and you'd get the tractor back to the shop and you would fix it. Well, but the autonomous tractor can't smell, all right? So it's going to wait for the coolant temperature to see a rise in coolant temperature, and it could be what they say, a delta T, the change in temperature, all right? But if you have a slow leak in the radiator and you're 5,000 acres away, all right, before the engine is going to see an elevated coolant temperature, then it's too late at that particular point, all righty? So let's go through another thing. All right, your autonomous tractor is going through the field, and then I'm in the other field with my auto steer tractor, and I'm going down the field, and we both happen to run over a corn stalk, and we pop a tire, not completely, put a fast slow leak, if that makes any sense. Right now. As a person in there, I could say, man, look at this. Look how the steering wheel is starting to correct in the auto steer. Look at the angle it has to go. Or I could feel, geez, it feels a little bit different. Whoop, 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 whoop. Or I could hear something, right? The autonomous tractor can't anticipate that. Yes, could it put a wheel speed sensor on there? But then we have to have a wheel speed sensor that's going to recognize, have an algorithm to recognize at what particular point does it do something, all right? Does it stop the tractor, what have you? And or does it do nothing whatsoever until the tire is completely flat, and now you're riding on a $3,000 tire on a rim, compacting your soil, ripping everything up, and if that sensor, arguably skewed, which is, as time goes on, that sensor skews, the sensor does skew, skew meaning its range goes out, then what happens then? Right, so those are very simplistic things, and then again, that is extremely complicated to almost impossible to mimic the human operation and try to engineer and prepare for all of these events. And then I'm not even going to go into whatever happens if the GPS grid goes off, or let's say, hey, you know, people are buying these planters with all this 2020 seed sensor and all these different great controls on it and downforce monitors. So how does the autonomous tractor know that one of your 16 row units is basically not singulating properly? So you could say, well, I can make a code for that and what have you. And I'm going to close today, and I'm going to say to you once again, this is no disrespect to the engineers, but what they're trying to do is make a machine that has the ability that the good Lord gave his creation. And it'd be impossible for them to make a machine that has the ability to reason, think, smell, see, and analyze in a split second like a mouse does running through your grain bin. When he sees you coming at him or sees something, how he could respond, or a squirrel going across the road, or a fish in a lake, or even a worm in the ground. So the thing is that, so is autonomy the answer? No. Is auto steer, a higher level of auto steer, the answer? We probably, in my estimation, we hit our plateau with auto steer. Now, will this technology advance? Yes, it will. And is it good? Yes, it is. And it'll probably eventually end up with a higher level of auto steer. But my thought, and I hope I made a convincing argument, is that I would rather see the companies put that engineering prowess and that money into, instead of an autonomous tractor, in making advancements in engine design, fuel efficiency, emission reduction, transmission technology, and many other things that could give the farmer a real return on his investment. And also, I'm not even saying what's going to happen to this autonomous tractor 15 or 20 years from now, when all of the wires are corroded, there's moisture in the connections, and what have you, and now all of the servos and solenoids don't respond as they do. So, to me, it's a great technology. Is it a practical application for a farm tractor or a piece of farm equipment? No. Is there some midpoint? Probably. Is it ever going to be on the road and be self-driving for cars and trucks? I doubt it very much. So I really think that your career behind the wheel of that beautiful tractor, listening to the Idle Chatter podcast, is very, very secure. And listen, there was no special delivery today. This whole show was brought to you by the good folks at Firestone Ag. And remember that they are the lineage of Harvey Firestone, and the same mindset that Harvey Firestone had back many, many years ago. I think the company's 100-something years old now. Is still alive today with their AD2 technology and 23-degree tread bar tire design, and now with the replacement tracks, the Firestone of replacement tracks. So I want to thank Firestone. I want to thank you for listening. Please give me your feedback at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com if you agree with me, disagree with me, and know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. You have a great week. Bye-bye.